Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science E7. This is Lecture 10, Digital Cameras. Now before we start talking about more digital cameras that we started talking about last week, there's just a couple of announcements that I thought I would mention. First of all, the fourth and final assignment has been posted. Of course, I sent the PDF to the printers and we unfortunately have not seemed to have gotten them this week. I couldn't find them, so you'll have to rely on the PDF version that's available on the course website. You can go and download it now. Or even when you get home, if you would like. And basically, this assignment is similar to the others, except for one big thing, and that is that you will actually get to create your own website theme. That you might have seen some of the themes that are available on the course website, and one of the things that you will do for assignment 4 is to create your own. And so what comes with a theme? Well, a theme is basically what you see here except for the text. It's the photos and it's the color scheme. And there's a little bit of additional metadata that's available that you will have to pick for this theme as well, just to provide like a title and a very short description and also just a short little text for how you want your name to appear. If you don't want your actual name to appear, you can use a pseudonym or something like that. But basically, we just require these three pieces of data so that we can fill in all of this information. So that you'll notice down here, for example, that it says the name it says my name down there, but also if it's somebody else's picture, it will say your name as well. It will say that the photo is copyright you, etc. And now the whole point of this is that you take this photo and you exercise a variety of things that you've learned up until this point. That is some basic image manipulation, namely cropping it down to the correct size. So resizing it first and then cropping it to the correct aspect ratio is very important. And we give you very specific instructions about the proper size that you need to do to submit a photo. If the photo is not the correct size or if there's a problem with your theme in general, unfortunately, we won't be able to post it on the website until it's corrected. So make sure that you get all of the technical details absolutely perfect. Otherwise, we won't be able to post it. Now, the color scheme is relatively simple. It's four colors that you will pick, and ideally, and really, you should pick these colors based on the color scheme that's available in your photo. So these colors were picked because they match relatively closely to what you see in the photo. Of course, it doesn't match exactly, but it's close enough. Now, you do have some constraints here, and that is that the text still has to be legible, for example. You can't pick color scheme where the text is now completely washed out or there's very little contrast. And also, you don't want to pick colors that are really horribly clashy with each other. It should look reasonably aesthetically pleasing. And so all of these things are left up to you. But fortunately, we do provide some links to a couple of websites that might be of use. And these same links are available in the problem set, so you don't have to worry about capturing their URL if you don't get them quite yet. But this one, what's its color? This one, color.org, excuse me, color without the last O. And this other one, let's see, Color Schemer Online, all of these will allow you to create this four-color theme. And so in essence, what you do is you upload your image or you provide your image to one of these first two websites, and they will tell you sort of the overreaching colors or the predominant colors that might be found in your photograph. And you can take that color or you can take that scheme of colors depending on what you might pick, and you can try to find complementary colors that might be that might fit it very well with this third and final website. So you might find a scheme of colors that works and still matches relatively well the overreaching color that you have or sort of the overall color theme that you have in your photograph. Now notice that we have four different colors that you'll have to pick, and they're labeled as such. So the first one is the page. The page is the background color for the entire page. And then let's see, one more is the content, which is this sort of this color here. This is the background of the content itself. Notice that there's two different colors here where text will be on top of it. Now there's also a text color, which on this theme is black, and it's the color of the text in the content, and also this color right here. So all of the content text will be that text color. And finally, the highlights. And highlights are used for links that are available on the page. So these links here, the links in the context, in the content rather, and also the highlight colors surrounding the content box and the and the image itself. So you have these four colors to pick, and you can try to make them relatively legible. And when you get a color scheme that you think might work, we actually have a tool that allows you to test your color scheme on the website. Now, this tool doesn't allow you to upload the image itself, so you can't see your theme as a whole, but basically all you have to do is enter the four colors that you pick. I'll just enter some here, and we'll see what it looks like. Let's see, hopefully this isn't going to be too bad. So you enter in the four colors that you've picked, the page, the content, the highlight, and the text, and then you can click the button, try this theme, and it will change the colors to match whatever it is that you've entered. Now, you might or might not be too familiar with the way that we are defining these colors. These colors are in a form called hexadecimal, and if you've done any sort of web work or any work on a web page, you might be familiar with this style. But basically, a hexadecimal number that looks like this is a 6-character number. And these six characters are broken down into three pairs. So you might have, we'll do it like this. RRGGBB. Which implies that the first two characters define the amount of red in this color. The next two characters define the amount of green in this color, and the last two characters define the amount of blue. And we go into a little bit more detail and provide some tutorials that you can find some additional information. But basically, you can break down these colors into those things. So the text, for example, you see it's all zeros, which represents black, as we've talked about before. Now, what makes hexadecimal sort of special is that the range of all of these characters can be not 0 to 9 like what we would expect in a normal decimal number, but instead 0 through F. And that's because at each place can we have 16 different values. So we can have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 like we're used to. And then A represents the value 10, B represents the value 11, so on and so forth. So in this way, we can use few characters to denote quite a few number of characters. And so that's why you see some of these characters here. FF, for example, means that there is all of this. It's the highest value possible for red, which means that pixel has the highest quantity of red available. And again, there's more detail in the problem set, but you will use hexadecimal numbers to define your theme. And so once you've submitted your theme, we will update the website, assuming that you meet all of the technical details properly. We'll post your theme on the course website, and you can show it off to all of your friends. In fact, you can see all of the themes that we have available right now on the theme picker. All of them are just from us staff, so some from me, Chris, John, and Kane are all available here. And when you see your own, you'll be able to just click on a button and choose that theme and use it for the duration of your time here at CSE7. Okay, so with that said, any questions on the last and final assignments? Yes. You can pick your own colors, but the colors should be related to the photograph, which is why we recommend using these websites. You don't have to use the websites. They're just there as tools that might benefit you in picking a color. But if you know that you have a specific color that matches pretty well, or you can even use something like Photoshop or a program. There's various programs on Mac and PC. Like one of them that I use a lot is the Digital Color Meter, which looks something like this as soon as it loads, which basically just allows me to hover my mouse over something and it tells me the color values, RGB, you can see it tells me the color values there. So you don't have to use the websites that we provided, but it might just make things a little bit easier for you because it helps you identify the largest or the, you know, the color theme that you have in your image in the image that you've supplied. Any other questions? Okay, so with that, this is the last assignment besides the final project, and so you have, the usual 3 weeks for this, and I think you'll have fun with this last one. Now, just as some quick review from some of the material that we went over last week, when we started talking about digital cameras, we introduced this idea of a cropped sensor, that not all sensors are, of course, the same size, and that if you use a different size sensor behind a lens that has the same focal length, you actually get this crop factor. You're cropping out the field of view, and you're making it appear as though you're using a longer lens. So in other words, if you have a smaller sensor that's underneath a lens that is the same size, you will get to more zoomed in, or it will appear as though it is more zoomed in. And we call this the crop factor, the field of view crop factor, the format factor. There's a whole bunch of names that we could give to this particular thing, but basically it just means that a smaller sensor putting a lens in front of it makes it appear as though you're using a longer lens, though clearly you're maintaining the same focal length for this lens. And so we gave this image as an example where this is an image circle that's given by a lens. So in other words, you put a lens in front of a scene and it's displaying it's focusing the scene itself onto the background and producing an image that looks like this circle right here. Lenses are circular, so the image that they produce is actually circular. The reason that we have rectangular images is because, well, our sensors are rectangular, our film is rectangular, but we could actually get circular images like this if we had circular film, which wouldn't make much sense. But anyway, so here we have now some rectangles inside. The red rectangle represents a full-frame sensor, a 35 millimeter full-frame sensor, and the blue represents a smaller sensor, like the APS-C size that we would see in a typical digital SLR. And we can see the results here. If we made both the same size, we could see why one would appear to be more zoomed in than the other. And so basically, to make all of these, to talk about lenses and to talk about the way that we use lenses on cameras in sort of an equal way, we normalize all of this by using the focal length multiplier. So in other words, if you have an APS-C sensor, it's 1.6 times smaller than a full-frame sensor, and so you would multiply that value, 1.6 times the focal length, to figure out what the equivalent lens on a 35 millimeter full-frame sensor would have to be to make it appear as though you have the same field of view with some specific lens on the smaller sensor. And so we use this to normalize all of this information. Now, we also talked about how decreasing the size of a sensor impacts some other things as well, most notably the amount of light that we can capture. If we have a much smaller sensor, not only is the sensor itself smaller, but also all of the pixels have to be smaller, especially if it's a very high megapixel sensor itself. And so as a result, it gets fewer photons. It can only capture so many photons, and that amount has decreased by some amount. Now, we also talked about how shrinking a camera can have this result that what we've seen, where smaller cameras tend to have more depth of field. And while we said that's true in a sense, that when you use a camera, that seems to be the case, it's not absolutely true that it's inherent to just the fact that it's a small camera. The reason that we have this problem is that we had to shrink everything, including the aperture itself. And if we make the aperture the same size in a big camera, the same actual physical size, and not just the ratio, if we correct for the ratio and use the same size aperture in a big camera as we do in a small camera, then we can actually match the depth of field between the two. So in essence, what we're saying is that compact cameras, while impressive as they are limited by the physics of their size. And so using a bigger camera provides us with more options, and there's not really a way that we can get around that. It's just a matter of physics. We have more capability out of a larger camera just because we have a wider range of apertures that we can use. We can use much larger apertures, which provide to us a much larger or much shorter depth of field. In other words, we can get much better background blur, much more quantity of background blur in an image. Now, from this, we talked about how we can use pixels to talk about ISO. And so essentially, ISO is not really increasing the sensitivity of the sensor necessarily, but what it is doing is it's taking all of the values that it does read and multiplying them by some factor. So at ISO 200, for example, it allows the pixel bucket that we used as an analogy to fill up halfway, and it doubled it. And it said, okay, this is how much, this is completely bright now for this pixel, and beyond that would be too much. It's too bright. And we continue with that. And so we use this as a way of talking about how this actually decreases the dynamic range of a camera. As you increase the ISO, you are going to see that the dynamic range of your camera decreases by necessity, just by the way that it works. So using the lowest ISO that you can generally means that you will get the best dynamic range out of your camera. And finally, we talked about a couple of the different types of sensors, how there's passive pixel sensors, or the CCD, that's most common in compact digital cameras, and then there's the larger there's the active pixel sensors, which are typically found in the larger cameras. And we said that the difference is that counterintuitively, the active pixel sensors use more energy, but they are a little bit less they have a little bit less noise. The CMOS sensors use less energy, but they have a little bit less noise than the CCD sensors. The CCD sensors have to use more energy to capture an image, but they also have less noise. And this is very important when using them in compact cameras, because compact cameras already have, you know, they battle with noise to begin with, just by their nature. And so this is one way that they are able to combat this problem. Now, when we talked about sensors, we talked about the pixel size, and we used this analogy that they're basically a bucket, how photons can fall into this bucket like rain would fall into a bucket, and that this is how we capture light. And so when we talk about dynamic range, this became very important, because we talked about how dynamic range is defined by the maximum amount of light that we can capture in this bucket divided by the minimum amount that we can actually read. And so smaller buckets capture light, the same amount of light, more quickly, just by their nature. There is a smaller bucket, so it will fill more quickly. And so we'd have to use fewer quantities of light to get that bucket to fill up the same amount. But the problem with this, of course, is that now we might get a little bit more noise. And so this is just inherent with the way that sensors are shaped, or not shaped, but it's inherent with the size of the sensors, and this is something that we try to get, we try to use technology to try to combat. But of course, pixels are a bit more complicated than just this oversimplification. And in fact, one pixel can actually be pretty complicated. So I know that, you know, not everybody here is an electrical engineer, and I don't expect anybody to understand what this means, but there's one thing that I want to point out. If this is one pixel, you can see there's a lot of stuff in this pixel, but there's really only one place in this entire diagram where light can actually be detected, and that is by this thing right here, where the light is sort of hitting it. That's the one place in this entire pixel where light can be gathered, and the rest, if light falls on it, it doesn't matter. If light falls on this transistor over here, it doesn't matter what happens, because this is not going to be able to capture any light. So we've talked about how maximizing the area of us being able to capture light is really important for us to capture as many photons as we possibly can. But there's this problem now where pixels are made up of so much stuff that we can't actually make the light gathering aspect of the pixel large in any sort of real sense of the word. So there's all this additional circuitry. There's three transistors for every one photodiode. So there's these three transistors right here that do stuff that allow us to actually read the data. And then there's only this one photodiode that takes up a relatively small fraction of the size of the pixel itself. So the photodiode is obviously very small. So how can we fix this problem? How, if you were confronted with this problem, how would you say in a real-world way that we could try to capture as much light over a pixel as possible? Let's try doing this another way. So assume for a moment that I don't know why this analogy came up, but if you were a little kid, for example, and you know that the sun is beating down on a hot summer day, and you want to fry an ant, how do you fry this ant? How do you focus all of this energy into one small point? So you basically use a lens, right? You use a little, like a magnifying lens, or use some lens, some way of capturing all of this light that's dispersed over a larger area to funnel it into one small point. And so in this case, our poor little ant is this photodiode, but that's essentially exactly what happens in a real-world pixel. There are millions of tiny, what are called micro lenses, that sit on top of a pixel whose sole purpose in life is to focus this light that's coming onto the sensor down into this one tiny portion of the pixel where light can actually be detected. So we have a micro lens that looks like this. It's at the very top. You can see the rays of light that are coming down. And this micro lens focuses the light down into what's called the pixel well. There's all of this stuff, all of the circuitry on the side, and it focuses it down into the well where the photodiode itself actually exists. So in this way, we can greatly increase the amount of light that we can capture on a pixel just by focusing all of the light that's available down into this one part. You'll notice that there's a whole bunch of layers that are here, and we'll talk about some of these. We've already talked about this, though. This is the circuit itself. This is the photodiode. This is how all of the light, this is the well, rather, that all of the light has to be focused down into. We'll talk about what this red thing is in just a moment. But micro lenses are actually a big way, a big technological advance in increasing the light gathering capability of a sensor can be focused on the micro lens right here. Every time a manufacturer improves their micro lens to capture more light or to send light more efficiently down into the pixel well, will we get better light performance out of a camera. So it's more than just electrical or sort of this technological increase that helps digital cameras get better. It's also this optical advantage. As we keep getting better with this optics, do we get better performance? And so this is one big reason. If they can make the micro lenses even bigger so that the micro lens of one pixel actually touches the micro lens of another one, rather than one being smaller than one being just a little too small to capture all of the light in that one pixel, then we can gather more light and we can do a better job. And in fact, this is one of the big ways that we've made strides in recent years, is through an improvement in micro lens technology, which has just allowed us to use the same sensors to get much less noise, or we can even make the sensors a little bit smaller and get the same amount of noise that we got a couple of years back. So using this micro lens is really important. And notice that the light notice that the pixel actually has a depth. There is this idea of this sort of well where photons have to go down into in order to be captured by the pixel itself. And if we have, say, pixels at the very edge of the sensor where light isn't necessarily coming straight on but from the side, it's sort of this strong, acute angle, this is another thing that the micro lens helps us do. It allows us to capture light that's coming in not straight down into the pixel but at this acute angle, and allows us to capture that light as well. So it's very important for our performance of these cameras. Now, I've mentioned this last week as sort of a teaser, but I want to reiterate the fact that these pixels, this photodiode that exists in the circuit, cannot actually detect color. All they can do with current technology is capture grayscale light. They can just capture the intensity of light, whether it's very bright, whether it's very dark. There's no way of knowing what color that light is. So how are we able to accomplish this? Well, you might have noticed that there was this red layer right here. That's exactly what this red layer does. It is essentially a color filter. And this color filter, very much like those 3D glasses from the original 3D movies, where you would put them on and they would filter specific colors out, so you would see only one color coming in one eye and only the other color out of the other eye. That's essentially what we are doing with these filters. We have a color filter array that exists on top of the sensor itself that filters out other light so we can only detect, say, the red, the amount of red that's coming in at that pixel, or the amount of green that's coming in at that pixel, or the amount of blue that's coming in for that pixel. So we have these three colors that correspond to all of these primary colors that we've talked about up until this point, red, green, and blue. And we capture this data through this color filter array. But there's obviously a problem. That is that these pixels are square, they're not triangular, and we only have three color filters. So in other words, we have a red color filter, a green color filter, and a blue color filter. How do we arrange them on a sensor that's meant to be rectangular? How do we arrange them so that they're relatively even, so that it makes sense in this arrangement of the color filter? Well, there's several answers for this, and there's different arrays. There's different ways that people have arranged these colors onto a rectangular plane, but the most popular one is called a Bayer color filter array. A Bayer color filter array basically looks like this, where we have a predominance of green color filters compared to red and blue. Now, there's actually a whole bunch of color filter arrays that are available, but this one happens to be the most popular, and most manufacturers actually use this one. Some manufacturers use different color filter arrays, and they advertise them as sort of being better as a result of them having something that's a little bit different. Some manufacturers use color filter arrays that have other colors as well, like cyan color filters or even yellow ones, and they try to use this to their advantage saying, okay, well, now we're able to capture the yellow or the cyan in a scene a little bit better than these other manufacturers. But I'm not sure that that's really ever held up in any sort of technical way, and certainly one of the advantages to everybody using this Bayer filter is that it's now everybody is very good at using a Bayer color filter array. They know how to optimize the result out of this Bayer color filter array, and so it's obvious now, it's well optimized, and it's very good, the results that we can get out of this. The early ones were not so good, and I'll explain why in just a moment. But again, we notice that there's a whole bunch of green in this. Why is there green rather than, say, blue or red? Why did they decide to go with the green version? Right, so because of the way that we detect light, where green is the most important to us for intensity. So green has this extra amount of importance for this luminance detection in our eyes. And so as a result, they say, okay, green seems to be the most important color, so we should therefore have the most amount of green. And so we can basically look and see that how we can define one color out of this. We have to recombine all of this data. We have to look at pixels that are neighbors to each other and try to figure out what the original color was. Because now what we're doing is we're taking a color that happens to be in existence, like yellow or cyan or some other mixture of colors, and we're breaking it apart so that each pixel can only detect some wavelength. So in other words, this far upper left pixel, for example, can only detect blue. If the actual scene was cyan, it's not going to detect that it's cyan. It's only going to detect that there's a blue component within this aspect of the scene. So in other words, the sensor breaks apart all of the colors into just these individual components. And in order for us to view the recombined image, what we have to do is exactly that. We have to figure out a way of recombining this data, recombining all of this color information back into the original color of the scene. And this is a process that's called demosaicing. So whereas we had mosaicked all of this into sort of this funky intermediate step where we have these pixels that are of varying green intensities and pixels of varying blue intensities and pixels of varying red intensities, we have to be able to recombine this data to get the actual original colors that existed. So if we look at the Bayer filter head on, we would see something that looks like this, where it's basically, if we can see that we have this repeating pattern where it goes, essentially, we break them apart into four pixels, and each of these four pixels have a very well-defined pattern where it's red in the upper left, then green, green, and then blue. And then it's, again, so it's, you have this square of four pixels that follow this pattern. And you can see that pattern repeats throughout this Bayer. And so we can see the same thing if we go back here. It's the exact same pattern. It's flipped in this case, but it's exactly the same thing. We have these four pixels that meet that pattern, and that entire set is repeated and repeated and repeated. So what this allows us to do is we can then look at the set of four pixels that neighbor each other and try to figure out what color that is. So we can divide this set of 16 different pixels, combine them into what are essentially four pixels, and we can think of what's in the center, what would be the color that's at the center of these four pixels. And so we look at the center of these and we try to determine, okay, the color that was made up by these four intensities at these four locations might be something like a yellow or a green. And so it says then that the pixel, the color for that pixel should be the combination of those things, like we see here. So what is essentially pixel number one? It's not the pixel at that location, but rather it's a combination of the colors that existed on those four pixels. So you can see that maybe this is not maybe this is not the best way of going about this. In other words, this introduces some problems that become very apparent, and I'll show you in just a little bit. But these problems include things, well, maybe there's going to be a little bit of an error in this problem, in recombining and performing this demosaic. What if, for example, we had some very fine detail that occurs, and this detail changes enough that every other pixel has a different value. So maybe we have something like some very fast repetitive pattern. Maybe you're looking at zebra stripes, for example, a black line followed by a white line followed by a black line. And these stripes are very thin, and they're thin enough, they're high frequency enough, in other words, that each one corresponds to a row, or rather a column of pixels here. So if this line was completely black, for example, and this line was completely white, for example, it becomes difficult to tell in this algorithm what is correct, because we know that there should be no color. There should be no color bias in a black and then white and then black and then white set of columns. But if we recombine it and we say, okay, that upper left pixel, that red pixel, has no value because it's black. And that green pixel has no value because it's also black. And then we have another green pixel, but this one's white. And then the blue pixel is white. There has to be some mathematical way of recombining this. And this is, in fact, a difficult problem, and it's not perfect. This demosaicing is not a perfect algorithm, and we do have problems that arise just because of the nature of the beast. And I'll show you those in just a little bit. So we can perform a few more computations, though, and get even more pixels out of it. So you'll notice that what we did initially was we broke down these 16 pixels into four quadrants. So we had an upper left quadrant and an upper right quadrant, and then we combined all of these to get an original color, the original color that existed over those four pixels. But we can do the same for the intermediate pixels as well. So whereas what we've done was we got the pixels from the color information from these four pixels here, notice that it's essentially the same thing to shift down one set of pixels and perform the same thing. So we can say, okay, well, now I can perform the same demosaicing on these four pixels right here, because it contains the same pattern, essentially. There's two green pixels, there's a blue pixel and a red pixel, so I can also figure out what color existed between these four pixels as well. So with this, we can recombine the vast majority of the colors in this image. And in fact, from these 16 colors, if we get all of the colors that exist between all of them, we can see that we can get back 9 colors from these 16 pixels. Now, one of the big things that happened in digital camera marketing a few years ago was this the number of effective megapixels versus the actual number of megapixels, and it didn't make a lot of sense why there was this implication that not all of the pixels on the sensor were being used. Well, this is exactly what's happening. We can't use the pixels at the very edge. We can't use only this green and blue pixel because there's not enough information to recombine the color from just these two. So in essence, we had 16 pixels here, but we could only recombine them to 9. We could only accurately recombine them to 9 pixels in the end. So what we had was an actual number an effective number of megapixels of 9 in this very simple sensor here, because those are the number of megapixels, or those are the number of pixels that we could actually get out of this sensor. But we had an actual number of pixels of 16, because that's actually how many physical pixels existed. But because of this demosaicing algorithm, we can't get the colors that exist at the very far edge of the sensor. So we have to lose some of this data that's there. Or we can only use this data a couple of times rather than using those pixels to recombine them to be all of the original pixels that existed. So this is definitely a problem. And some of the engineers that were working on this were trying to come up with a solution. Is there a way that we can fix this problem where we're essentially wasting pixels. We have to use more pixels in it, or we have to create more pixels in a sensor, and we can't actually create an image that has that many pixels that the sensor actually contains within it. So is there a solution to this? And they came up with a different type of sensor that tried to address this problem. And this sensor is unfortunately not it's not something that you hear about a lot, but it is actually a sensor that does exist, and it's called a Foveon X3 sensor. And this sensor has one pixel that the photodiodes themselves cannot detect individual colors. It cannot detect color, it can only detect intensities of colors. What happens in this case is that they use some optical tricks to try to divide the color into the three primary colors rather than using this sort of color filter array. So this color filter array, I mean, it obviously has some problems. Besides this demosaicing issue that we were just talking about, it also has the problem of destroying some of the resolution, because we're making a guess about the color that exists between these four pixels. We're making a guess. We don't actually know the real color that resulted in this, because we're throwing away data. In essence, if we have a filter that does something that looks like this, we're throwing away a good amount of data that existed. Because here, assume that we have a red color filter array that's on top of this pixel. It means that it is rejecting, that it is absorbing all of the photons that are in the blue and green frequency. So in other words, those blue and green photons, or if they existed, they don't anymore. We just threw that data away. We lost it. And so we're throwing away a good percentage of the light that existed in the scene just so that we can try to detect the color. We're essentially throwing away almost two-thirds of the light, give or take. I mean, these color filter arrays aren't perfect, but still, we're throwing away probably about two-thirds of the light that existed in the scene when we're capturing this data. So this was a bad thing. And so what they said was, what if we were able to capture all of this information at the individual pixel level? So they designed a different type of sensor that does just that. And so this is still an active pixel sensor. It's a CMOS sensor. But what it does is it uses the absorption properties of silicon to capture the different frequencies of light. So for example, if we have white light that's being shined onto some silicon, it depends on so light will continue traveling through it up to a certain point. And depending on the frequency of that light, it will travel farther or shorter distance, depending on the energy and the frequency of the light. So we notice here, for example, that blue doesn't travel very far through this. So if you have a very thin amount of silicon, blue can go through it, but it will stop very quickly if you have a thicker amount. So the thicker layer of silicon that you have, the more likely that your light is going to be captured, or rather just be stopped. It's just going to become more and more opaque. And this sort of makes sense in a way, but what the real breakthrough was here was that they determined that depending on the energy of the light, so red would travel much farther through silicon than green would or than blue would. And they can use this property. They can say, okay, well, if I know that green is going to travel a certain amount through silicon, I will put a sensor there, and that will be my green sensor. And then I can put a red sensor embedded a little bit farther into the silicon, and then I'll be able to detect any red frequencies that are there. So from here, we can see what they did. They layered, they had a thick, well, relatively thick layer of silicon, and they embedded sensors at different depths. So at the very highest point is the blue sensor, and that detects all of the blue frequencies. Then at the next point, they had the green sensor, and that detects all of the green frequencies. Then at the very bottom, they detect all of the red frequencies. Now, it's a little bit misleading to say that the sensor at the very top detected only blue. It detected everything, right? Because blue, not only will blue travel to that region, but so will the green and so will the red. So they had to have some fancy math to try to subtract out the other frequencies that were there. But that was relatively trivial compared to, well, at least I assume it's relatively trivial, compared to what we had to do here with the color filter array, with recombining all of these colors. And so this was nice, because now at a single individual pixel, can we actually detect the color that existed? We don't have to make a guess about the color that exists at that point, at that location. So this allowed for a similarly sized sensor to have fewer pixels. because it wasn't necessary. If you have one pixel that can do the work of four pixels, then you can have a fewer quantity of them. So the foveon sensors tend to be lower megapixels, and frankly, I think this is one of the reasons why they just didn't do so well, because they would have, for example, 4 megapixels they would say that they have 4 megapixels, and the average consumer would look at that and say, oh, it sounds really low. And in fact, it is low compared to the number of megapixels that we would have in a Bayer-type camera. But the fact of the matter is that each one of these pixels is doing much more. It's providing much more information to us than one pixel in the Bayer-type camera. And this was a big advantage. The fact that one pixel was doing more was a big advantage, but the downside was that we had this lower amount of megapixels. So we have more light captured and one pixel, because this pixel itself is bigger, and it's doing more. We can capture all of the color information there. So this was a good thing. This meant that Foveon actually had quite a big advantage over their Bayer cousins. But there were some problems as well. Because we are using this technique, we would actually get some noise in the blue sensor. We don't actually know. Well, I mentioned before that we have to do some fancy math to try to subtract out the amount of green and red that might have existed up in the blue sensor. And this wasn't perfect. The math wasn't perfect, and so you would get this sort of chromatic noise that would exist in some of these images, where you would see that some pixels just would change in their blue intensities a little bit. This was just sort of a problem at higher ISOs. And frankly, though, I think a lot of people were very harsh on the Foveon sensor for this fact, but I think had the Foveon sensor been allowed to mature as much as some of these other sensors have, we might not see that to be as big of an issue. I know that cameras are still available with the Foveon sensors, but their development is just much slower than the other cameras that we see today. So just to give you an example of how we might compare these two types of sensors, I have here photos that are essentially the same things taken from two different cameras. On the left is a Canon 5D, and a Canon 5D is a very well-respected full-frame sensor camera that uses a Bayer filter on top of its sensor. And this is considered to be one of the highest quality sensors that are available on the market, at least when it was released. This is the original 5D, and this was considered to be a very high-quality sensor that was released on the market. And on the right is a Sigma SD14. And this camera has a Foveon-type sensor within it. And the Foveon type, as we just talked about, has fewer megapixels, but each pixel is doing more. So notice that we have here essentially three photographs. So if we look at the 5D picture on the left, and let's take a look at this upper left-hand one with this sort of the pink stems that are coming up from this flower, we can compare that to the original size of the Foveon sensor. So recall that there's fewer megapixels. So when we look at both at 100%, there's going to be the picture on the Sigma side is going to be a little bit smaller because there's just fewer megapixels. But if we resize, if we make the Sigma image bigger to match the size of the 5D image, that's the bigger picture on the far right. So we've resized it bigger than 100% to match the size of the 5D camera. And now pay attention to the sharpness between these two images on both of these examples, and you'll notice where the Sigma really shines. So if we take a look, I'll zoom in a little bit, at how the 5D camera looks. This is how the 5D picture looks. It looks, and again, I'm zoomed in a little bit, so it looks a little bit blurrier than it would normally. But right here, we can see that it looks relatively sharp, but if we compare it to the picture that came out of the Sigma camera, we can see that the Sigma camera gets the lines absolutely perfect. You'll notice that here, there seems to be just this sort of fuzziness that exists on this diagonal portion of all of these lines, and that's because of the Bayer filter. This pink area, this was a very sharp line that goes across diagonally some of these pixels that are in the Bayer filter sensor. So if we have a pink line that's going diagonally like this, the camera still has to try to determine which of these pixels are pink But it, like I said before, it can only make a guess. It really doesn't know which ones are. And so it will sort of, it will make it a little bit fuzzier as it tries to make this, to demosaic this and make this assumption about where these pink pixels are compared to the sigma one, which is just, which has very sharp, well-defined lines. Well, okay, I over-zoomed in a little bit. Which has very sharp, well-defined lines, just because each individual pixel, if there's one pixel that's pink and then an adjacent one that's not, that sensor will know the difference. It won't try to commingle the two pieces of data and try to determine what's going on between these pieces of information. So essentially what happened when we increase the size of the fovean sensor, we see that even though we increase it a little bit, it still remains sharp. And that's just because all of these pixels are very sharp. Each individual pixel is very, very sharp compared to the pixels that we would get out of a Bayer sensor. And that's where we can see the same thing with the leaf here. There's just more definition, especially with these lines that exist in the leaf, where the Bayer sensor just has to sort of smudge it out a little bit, maybe because these white lines were too fine of a resolution for it to be over both of these pixels at once. Did I see a question? So, so Bayer isn't necessarily an older technology. It's just that it still exists today, but it's not in use. It's not as popular as the Bayer technology. And so what I'm showing you here is that there's other types of sensors that are available. It's just that the ones that have become popular, and frankly, they might have become popular maybe just because their megapixel ranking was higher than the other ones. This is sort of further the point that megapixels are not everything in this case. So even though this camera has many more megapixels, it doesn't really matter as much because the individual pixels in this other type of sensor are sharper, they're better, they have more quality to them. So it really is this idea that we have. It really does show, I think, some of the weaknesses of the current technology that we have. And like I said, it's really sort of disappointing that we don't get to see these manufacturers work on fovean-type sensors as much as they have the Bayer type, just because these fovean sensors do seem to have a lot of potential within them. So if we compare one more thing. So recall that I said if we have a very high-frequency pattern, so in other words, if we have a pattern that changes a lot, the fovean sensor will be able to capture this detail much more easily. So for example, this is this is the intersection of someone's shoe and their jeans, basically. And what you're seeing is the pattern of jeans in this right up here, this blue alternating blue and white pattern. It's a jean pattern, which you're probably you probably have seen. And with the fovean sensor, because this pattern occurs quickly enough, in other words, the change between the white and the blue occurs essentially on the pixel level, the fovean sensor is able to capture it relatively well. But the Bayer sensor, if this same thing happens, where it's a white pixel, then a blue, white column, then a blue column, then a white column, the Bayer, the demosaicing pattern is going to mean that some artifacts occur because it has to make some guesses about what's going on. If this column is white and this column is blue, how does it recombine that information to create a meaningful color? Well, just based on this demosaicing pattern, we actually get some interesting artifacts. Notice that we actually get some maze-like color here. We actually get this weird maze-like pattern that exists. It's not this straight pattern that we had seen in the genes itself, but it becomes this sort of maze pattern, and we also just get this rainbow-like color alteration. So it goes from this sort of yellow to blue to yellow. Do you see that where the mouse is right here? This is yellow, and then changes to be a little bit of blue, and then this is yellow again. So we're actually producing artifacts in this Bayer sensor. And in fact, this happens in all of your cameras. This exact thing happens. But they try to combat this problem a little bit by putting a filter on top of all of this stuff that we've talked about. So we talked about how there's the pixel, there's the sensor well, there's the pixel as a whole, there's the color filter array, there's the micro lens. Now on top of all of this stuff, does there exist something called a low-pass filter? And this low-pass filter, all it's supposed to do is essentially make things a little bit smoother. It just tries to make them, it just tries to remove some of these high-frequency details, make things a little bit smoother, as you can see here on this far right image. Now, when we have removed a lot of these high-frequency patterns with this filter, we remove all of these artifacts, but the downside that you can see is that we also lose resolution. It looks to be softer of an image. It doesn't look as sharp as it would. And this is actually something that you can also notice. I mean, there is going to definitely be a problem with Bayer color filter arrays. They have to put an anti-aliasing filter, or in other words, a low-pass filter, on top of their sensor to remove these patterns that will become very visible to people in pretty much any image that they take that has any sort of high-frequency patterns. So just by the nature of the beast, they have to remove all of the detail that they would otherwise be able to capture, which is sort of at odds with this increasing quantity of megapixels. Because if they have to make these details smoother, why do they have to increase the number of megapixels? Of course, they can make, if they have higher quantities of megapixels, they can tone down the low pass filter a little bit. But still, this is definitely an issue where we lose a lot of the detail that we had originally in the scene just by having this anti-aliasing or low-pass filter on top. And in fact, when you take your camera, if you have an SLR camera and you pop up the mirror so you can actually see the sensor, what you see is not actually the sensor itself, but you see the combination of all this stuff that we've talked about. The low-pass filter is the very top portion of the sensor. And when you're cleaning your so-called sensor, you're not cleaning the sensor itself, you're cleaning this low-pass filter that happens to sit on top of your sensor. Now, usually all of these things are sort of like one, they're all combined to be one thing. So if you scratch the low-pass filter, you mess up the low-pass filter, you're out of luck because you're going to have to replace the whole thing. But it's just an important distinction to realize that what you're touching when you open up the camera and you try to clean it off is not the sensor itself, but instead this filter, this low-pass filter that exists. Okay, so we've talked about how there's a whole bunch of stuff on top of a pixel. In fact, there is. There's the color filter array, there's the micro lens, which actually I think helps us more than it harms us, and there's also this filter. And so in a typical sensor, we have all of these layers that are essentially, while necessary for us, just because we want to have color pictures and not black and white pictures out of all of this technology that we have, while it's certainly helping us, it also causes a bit of a problem, because at every layer, it's an additional way for light to be reflected off or to get absorbed or for something to happen. And so all of these additional layers hurt us in terms of this light gathering capability. We are reflecting the tiniest amount of light off of this low-pass filter. We are absorbing the tiniest amount of light in this color filter array, so we're not capturing all of the photons that we might have been able to had neither of these things existed. So we have this sort of play. And again, one of the overarching themes of this entire course is that everything in photography is this sort of give and take. It's this compromise. So we have to absorb this little bit of light or reflect this little bit of light in order for us to accomplish all of these things. It's just sort of a necessary evil, if you will. Okay, let's take a quick 5-minute break. And when we come back, we will talk about other types of unusual sensors. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. So I do just want to mention one more administrative thing, and that is that you really should take advantage of sections. We're starting to get into some pretty technical, nitty-gritty things, and I think that if you have any questions about anything, sections are a great way to go about it. So just as a quick reminder, we have sections every Monday at 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. in 53 Church Street, room 201, and immediately after lecture on Tuesdays from 7:30 to 9:30 in 51 Bryle Street, room 123/5. And so this is a good way not only to talk about all of these technologies that we're talking about and all of these relatively technical details, but also a good way to bounce ideas for your final project around, maybe show or get some help on more specific questions that aren't related to lecture topics. And it's definitely a good resource for that's available to all of you. So before the break, we were talking about different types of sensors. And one of these was the Foveon X3. And so I do want to be clear, while I talked about the foveon sensor in sort of a positive light, I also realize that it's not the most viable of technology, just by nature of the fact that it's just not updated very much. And it's really in use only in one, maybe two cameras by a third-party manufacturer called Sigma. And Sigma actually makes some pretty good things, because Sigma is sort of one of the major third-party lens manufacturers for Canon and Nikon cameras. They make lenses for both Canon mount and Nikon mount cameras. Those same lenses available for their own line of cameras, so they have a pretty good range of lenses that are available for their cameras. The fact of the matter remains that they just don't update these cameras. They just don't develop these new sensors very frequently, and we get sort of, I at least would get a little bit nervous towards the end of the development cycle of one of these cameras, wondering if they're going to actually release an updated one or not, or how locked in I'll be to this system. So it's definitely a concern that you should have. It's just interesting, I think, to know and to talk about these technologies, because there do exist these other really brilliant technologies that, if they were developed, could rival very easily, I think, what we have today. Now, one of the other technologies that's interesting was developed by Fujifilm, and this sensor was called their Super CCD SR, some stupid name like that. And this was interesting because what they had was, they had for every pixel essentially two pixels. They had a large pixel that was designed to capture low light, and they had a much smaller pixel that was adjacent to it that was much lower sensitivity, and this was designed to capture some of the higher intensities of light. And what would happen here is that you could recombine this data at a later point and be able to get much better performance out of this camera at the very high end. And what they said was that you can actually get maybe one or two stops of additional leeway before you start to overexpose the image. And I think some of the reviews backed this up a little bit, but it wasn't as impressive, as I recall, as they wanted it to sound. But it's just sort of an interesting idea that somebody had to try this sort of technique on a different type of sensor. Now, for us to talk a little bit more detail about how this data is read off of a sensor, we need to quickly take a step back and talk about the histograms, or at least remind ourselves about the histograms. So recall that the histogram is basically just a count of the various pixels that exist in an image, and there's different types of histograms. Most common one that you might see is the luminance histogram, which measures the apparent brightness of an image. Others include RGB, which measure the raw red, green, and blue values that exist in each pixel, and all of these other types that exist. And what's interesting, though, about the histogram is that it actually can tell us quite a bit about the dynamic range of a scene. Specifically, if you have a histogram that looks very narrow, like you do here, you can know that the histogram shows, or rather that the image that makes this histogram shows us that there's not a lot of contrast in this scene. So this image doesn't look like it has, it looks sort of gray. It looks like there's not a lot of contrast. And the reason for that is that the dynamic range of our camera is much larger than the dynamic range that happened to be in this scene. Now, if you actually went to this scene and took this photo, I'm pretty sure that this scene would have a higher dynamic range than the camera would. This is just an example to show you what this might look like. So notice that the dynamic range here is just, it's very compressed. It's just a bit too narrow for the dynamic range of our camera. And normally this is a good thing, but what happens if we have the opposite problem, where the dynamic range is too great for the camera? Well, it looks like there's a lot of contrast, but the problem with this is that we now get large areas of under and overexposure. And in fact, there's this intrinsic link between contrast and dynamic range. If you take a picture and you increase its contrast, what you are effectively doing is lowering the dynamic range of the camera, because it's stretching out all of these values outward on the histogram. So you're making gray areas blacker. You're making white areas whiter. And what's happening as a result of this is that you're cutting off much more quickly some of the pixels that were on the edge. Some of the pixels that might have had a little bit of detail are now going to be at complete completely black or completely white. So this is the risk of increasing the contrast. While it does look better for many people, just this sort of large contrast, there does exist this risk of overdoing the amount of dynamic range that you have available to you. So in this case, in this histogram, we have, again, just to reiterate, the dynamic range of this scene is too high, and we can see that because there's some regions that are just far too black and there's some regions that are just far too white for this camera to accurately capture the detail that exists there. So this is something that is certainly a problem in pretty much all in all images that you take, that you try to increase the contrast. And so just as an example, let's see, I think I have one here. If I show you this image, this image here has a certain amount of contrast. And what would happen if I tried to increase this contrast is that areas that are dark would appear to be darker, and areas that are bright would appear to be brighter. But recall that JPEG, in the JPEG file format, we only have a certain number of values that exist here. And so, excuse me. So what can happen is if I try to increase the contrast of this too much, and I'm talking about, you'd have to kind of go a little overboard with this, but this is certainly the case. If you try to stretch the contrast of an image a little bit too much, what you're doing is you're creating gaps between all of these values. So right here, this is not necessarily a very complex image. There's this gradient, the predominant portion of this image is a gradient from this sort of light blue all the way down to black. And this gradient, as you know, is defined just by a range of values from this sort of light blue down to black. And if we try to stretch this out in this JPEG, you can imagine that we might get these sort of gaps in the between the individual colors. And so what would happen as a result is that we would actually notice, rather than having a very smooth gradient like this, we might notice individual steps. So as blue would become noticeably darker at each one of these steps. And just to give you an example of this, I'm reopening this image, and I had to kill a lot of time because, of course, this computer takes forever to do anything in Photoshop. But I opened this image in the background in Photoshop, and as soon as it comes up, I'll show you what happens when we modify the contrast. Oh my gosh, okay. So again, we have these colors that are defined by the values, and as we stretch these values, we might get this sort of what's called this posterization effect. That's so called just because we get this noticeable difference in the colors. Okay, so this is opened in Photoshop, and what I'm going to do is adjust the brightness contrast. So I have here brightness and contrast. So let's see what happens as I increase the contrast. So what we expect, again, is dark areas to become darker and bright areas to become brighter. So we expect to notice a bigger difference in the between these two sections of the image. So as I increase the contrast, we can see that's starting to happen a little bit. And so that's certainly, if we go from 0 to 100, quickly, this is exactly what we see. Let me turn down the lights a little bit to make the effect a little bit more apparent. Oh, 1,000. Okay, 1,000 sounds good. Okay, so now hopefully this looks a little bit more obvious, the difference. Okay, so at 1,000, pay attention to what's happening at the individual pixel level. So what's, it is telling me that I can only do 100. Okay, so at 100, notice that this looks a little bit more contrasty. There was definitely quite a good amount of contrast in this image, but something that is really a little bit more apparent now is this posterization effect that you can really see here. It's this sort of this noticeable step as these colors become darker and darker. And this is because there were no intermediate colors to fill in the place of these that we have now stretched. And so just to go a little overboard, I'll do this one more time. Now this becomes even more apparent. Now you can really see what I mean, where there's this step from a bright color to a darker color to a darker color. And the reason for that is that the computer just does not have any knowledge about what might be intermediate steps right here. It only has those 255 different values to work with. And if you stretch those so that only, say, value 96 to 128 now become representative of those things, you're going to have these gaps in your image. And in fact, this is what happens if we take a look at the histogram. This is, it looks as though there are some gaps here, and this is exactly what I'm talking about. So this effect is called posterization, and this happens just as a result of us increasing the contrast and increasing it a little bit too much and getting these gaps between the values that we used to have at each individual pixel. Now, of course, we talked before about bits and bytes and all that stuff. Just a super quick review. A bit is a 0 or a 1. A byte is 8 bits or 256 discrete values. And there's something very important here that we're going to bring together about how the camera actually reads the data. So all of the data that exists, when all of the rain or all of these photons fall into the pixel, into our buckets, we have to have some way of reading this data off of the sensor. And a sensor is actually an analog device. It's not actually a digital device. It's actually an analog. It's as though whenever we measure it, it's not perfectly digital. We have to convert the sensor, the data that comes off of a sensor, into a digital format. We have to get it converted into this digital, ones and zero format that we are used to seeing on a computer. And so there exists this technology sort of in the background that is not referred to very much, but is very important for the quality of the production of our images, that's called an analog to digital converter. And it sits between these two steps. It sits between the sensor and the output. And its sole purpose in life is to take the value from the sensor and convert it into a digital value. So if we have a sensor, or if we have a pixel that's been filled this much, like this right here, it's a bucket that's been filled a certain amount, and we'll call this about 55% full, just to give you an example. So at all the way completely empty, it would be 0. At 100, it would be 1 up here. So we're about just a little bit over halfway, and we can see it's 0.55. Now, all of these are measured. I mean, this is an electrical device, so it's measured in volts. So it goes from 0 volts to just 1 volt, as an example. So we can read it, and we can say, okay, the value at this pixel is 0.55 volts. Now, the job of the analog-to-digital converter is to take this value and convert it to a digital value. So if we have 1 byte of information, if we want to have 1 byte of information, what we would say is that a completely empty bucket would produce all zeros, right? An all zero byte. And if we had a completely full pixel, it would be all ones. So what we have to do is figure out what value this maps to in a digital format. So 0.55 corresponds to, it's about 55% of 255, and we can figure out that this corresponds very nicely to 140, and we can convert this value to a binary output. So essentially what this means is that we are converting, and again, we're taking this full amount of the dynamic range of the pixel, and we're trying to convert it down into this digital representation. Now, what we have talked about before is that there's nothing special about these sensors. They don't view the world like our eyes do. They are very linear. So whenever the amount of light doubles, so does the quantity in this sensor. Now, if we convert this sensor to 256 discrete values, if we give it only 8 bits worth of information, what we're saying is that we only have a dynamic range of about 7 stops. Now, in other words, if we have a value of 1 that exists when this is almost completely empty, and we double it once, that gives us 2. We double it again to 4. We keep doubling it, so on and so forth. We find out that we can only double it 7 times before we get a full quantity. So, or in other words, we can go the other direction, which might make a little bit more sense. If we have a completely full pixel at, this pixel is completely full, and we map it to 255, that means that there can only be 7 stops darker information below it before we don't have enough resolution. Because if we divide that by 2, to half of 255 is about 128. Keep dividing it by 2, we get 64, 32, 16, so on and so forth. And eventually, we don't have that many values to represent one stop of information. So 8 bits, this is called a sampling. An 8-bit sampling is not quite enough. So all this means is that if we have a sensor that has a really high dynamic range, let's say for a moment that this sensor has a 10-stop dynamic range, and we only provide to it an 8-bit analog-to-digital converter, that means that we will not be able to capture the entire dynamic range that this sensor is able to capture. Because with 8 bits, we can only double it 7 times before we max out the number of values. So we're throwing away all of this additional data. So they have to use this sampling that's large enough that we can actually represent all of the different stops, all of the different the stops of information that the camera's dynamic range can actually provide to us. And so typically what you will see is that different cameras will have different analog to digital converters for this reason. So some cameras that are very high end will have 12-bit or even 14-bit sampling, which means that you have many more pieces of data to retrieve this value from. So just to give you an example, if we have this pixel, this is the same sensor. Let's say this is a 10-stop sensor, just as an example, and it's just over half full. And what we can look at is when we try to convert this to a digital number, we can say, okay, well, if I have 12 bits of information, that means that I have 4,096 different values to choose from. Now, keep in mind that this is a big jump over our 8-bit sampler, which only provided us with 256 different values. That's because every additional bit doubles the number of values that you have. So we have 4,096 different values, and so we can see that there's a lot more leeway in here to accurately pick a digital representation that matches the analog value that existed in this sensor. So there exists this issue here, where if we have an analog to digital converter that doesn't have such a high sampling amount, if it has too low of a sampling rate, what this can be is we can get a sampling, or what's called a quantization error. What if, for example, we weren't using such a nice value like 0.55? What if our sensor could actually tell the difference between 0.5551 and 0.5552? If our sensor can detect the difference between those two values, but we don't have a big enough sampling rate from our analog to digital converter, we are throwing away that data, just because there's no way for us to say in digital form that there's a difference between that 0.5551 and 0.5552, or whatever I said originally. So having a higher number of values that we can pick from gives us a lot better, a lot more accurate way of being able to identify the value of that sensor, and we get a higher quality picture as a result. Now, there is a downside to using a very high sampling rate in an analog to digital converter, and that is that if we go beyond 12-bit or 14-bit, it uses a lot more energy. It's going to be a lot more error-prone, but also it creates a file that is absolutely monstrous. And just because we have all of this data available in a file doesn't mean that we can really use all of it in a computer. If we have this monstrous file and our computer can't even recognize, 16 bits of color information, then it doesn't really matter all that much. But having this extra additional data available to us provides to us additional ways of getting more quality out of our image. Now, we've talked about how sensors are linear. In other words, every time we double the number of photons, it essentially doubles the value that the sensor has itself. And so this implies that when we have a certain number of bits provided to one pixel, that there is an important section, or rather that some of the brightest stops of information have more values to work with. So for example, let's say that we are working with this 12-bit analog to digital converter, and what we want to do is convert our our data from our sensor into a digital output. Now realize that if we have 12 bits of information, that means that we have 4,096 different values to work with. But the sensor is linear. So that means that every time we have the values, that is one stop of information. So the first, the highest half of values in this 4,096 are devoted to one stop of information, the brightest stop of information that this camera can detect. And that's just because we're doubling it. So every time we have it, when we have this information to 2048, that means that this is half the brightness of this value right here, right? But there's an important distinction here, and that is that even though, because we've doubled this, we now have this many values. We have 2048 values that can be used to represent this brightest stop, which means that there's a lot of good granularity. There's a lot of good range in here. There's a lot of values that we can use to describe all of the brightness variations that exist in this brightest stop. And it goes down. As we look at the next brightest stop, we see that, okay, 1024 to 2048, that represents another stop of information. But this time, rather than us having available to us 2048 values for this stop, we have only half that at 1024. So now we still have a good number of values. We have 1,000 values to represent all of this range of light, but it's still fewer. And as we go down, as we get darker, this is what happens. So we can go down another stop and we only have 500 values. We can go down another stop and we have only 256 values. And this becomes a bit of a problem in that we have the very darkest stops of information are literally only separated by one value. So one value at the lowest end over here means the difference between one stop and the next stop. And then it's two values away is the next stop. And so there's this additional error that we have where we're giving too much predominance. We're giving too much importance to the brightest stops. And we're not giving quite enough importance to the darkest stops. Now this is the nature of the beast. And we have sensors that are linear, which means that every time we double the number of photons, it doubles the value. And when we convert that to digital, this is what happens. Just because of the way that light works, this is what we're going to see. And so this may not be such a bad thing, except that we have said before, our eyes don't work this way. If you looked at this image that was represented in this way, it would look very, very dark to our eyes. And that's just because we might have, how many times do you take a picture where everything in the picture is in the brightest stop? In other words, everything in the picture is highlights. You never do that, right? Usually it's properly exposed so that everything is sort of in the middle stops, which means that the majority of your data is down here. So if you looked at this picture and it's just linear and you see that, okay, well, there's all of this information up here, but there's not a lot of brightness. So what happens is this, if you look at a linear picture, it is going to appear very, very dark. So the cameras that we use, and pretty much every time you view an image, it is not shown to you in this linear way. This is what happens when it writes the raw file to memory or to the disk or what have you. It writes this linear data, but there's this intermediate step that has to happen when processing this data before we can view it with our eyes. Yes?
If you took a photograph with a high f stop, like let's say f22, but you leave the exposure for a long time, probably the shutter speed is open for like 20 seconds or something, let's say an evening photo, or anyways, in that kind of a scenario, do you have as much data as opposed to having a shooting something with a wider f stop?
Do you have as much data? I'm quite sure I understand.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if when you're shooting with higher f-stops, in essence you're having less color available or less data available. However, there are other ways to control light, with shutter speed is one of them.
Right.
I'm just wondering are you saying that in one way f-stops that are lower are better, or is it just that there are other ways to capture light and those can be equally valuable relative to the amount of data that's captured.
So realize that, stop is meant as a generic term. It's not necessary. I don't mean to imply a link between this stop and, say, the f-stop, like in the aperture, but instead... Right, so this really represents light value. So you can use a low f-stop, and you might have, you can use a low f-number, for example, and have a very fast aperture, a very fast shutter speed, or you could have a very very high f-number and use a very slow shutter speed. Either way, you're still gathering the same quantity of photons, and what we're talking about, this is the range that the sensor itself can capture, and so this is what we're... These are the stops that we are referring to, and not necessarily. This is different from the exposure values that we talked about before, because those exposure values, just to make clear, were what's important. We have to we have a certain range of light that our sensor can capture, below which is too dark, above which is too bright, and modifying those allows us to capture within that range. Yeah, no problem. Okay, so we have. We're talking about sensor linearity and how this puts too much importance probably on the upper stops than we would typically view a scene. When we view a scene, we don't see only the brightest portions of the scene, right? Like we don't see only the lights, or we don't see only the brightest portions of a scene. We see the scene in a way that looks a little bit, it gives more importance to these sort of midtones than what this would imply. So there has to be applied this correction, what's called a tonal curve, that gives importance, it takes importance away from these higher numbers, from these higher stops that contain the majority of the information, and it places importance back in this sort of mid-range, in this mid-range number of stops that we would consider sort of the middle tonal range. And this is how we can convert a linear sensor into something that looks much more like we would see the scene with our eyes. And in fact, this is how our eyes would generally see a scene. We put much more importance in this middle region than we would in the upper region. And so this graph shows you an example of a tonal curve. So what are we talking about with this graph? So imagine that we have a sensor that is outputting values in 12 bits of information. So recall that we just said that a 12-bit sensor will give us values from 0 to 4096. And the highest stop, or the highest half, rather, of bits are all devoted to this one brightest stop of information, and so on and so forth as we go down the chain. And that is what we are looking at on the x-axis here, is the linear version of the sensor scale right here. So that means that everything from 2000 to 4000, that's the brightest stop of information that was provided to us in this sensor. And as we've just talked about, this is not the most important stop that's available. So if we are going to convert this down to an 8-bit JPEG, where we have 256 discrete values to work with, we're going to make this higher range representative of a fewer number of the highest pixels. So this is what we're looking at. On the left side here is the output. It's what would be output to, say, a JPEG file, where we have a minimum number of 0 and a maximum number of 255. What we are doing is we are compressing the highlights. We are compressing these upper values to represent a smaller number of values in the output JPEG. And just to make that apparent, let's take a look at this point right here, which is meant to represent about the value 2000. So this upper stop of information is output to a JPEG only at about 200 or so, all the way up to 255. So it removes this importance where rather than mapping it straight, rather than saying, okay, all values from 128 to 255 represent this highest stop of information, what we're doing is we're compressing the highlights. We're saying all of this information has to be compressed down to just a few bits of information at the highest end of the JPEG, and this will map it much more closely to how our eyes would see the scene, would view the scene. And that's what's happening here. These middle stops from 500 or so all the way up to, I don't know, about just over 1,000, these are what are given the most values in the output JPEG. These are what are given the most importance in all of the bits, in the JPEG that is outputs. And again, we're doing the same thing down here, where these last few stops are just given very little importance. They're all compressed down to a zero, rather than giving them too much, too much importance in this scene as well. So this matches how we see. And so now if we come back to this idea that we had talked about just before with this idea of posterization, where if I had an image, if I had an image and it was a JPEG image and I was using the contrast slider to adjust the contrast of this image and I started noticing posterization, well, there's a way that we could fight against this posterization by using the original data that came out of the sensor. This original data, we had 4,000 different values to work with, and we had to condense 4,000 values down into something that fits into 255. So we are throwing away a huge percentage of the available data so that we can have it fit into a very common data type. And this is one of the biggest reasons why you might decide to use the raw format over JPEG. You are throwing away 3,750 or so pieces of information in favor of the 255 most important pieces of information, or what the computer is deciding to be the most important information. You're throwing away all of this data that you could have used when you're increasing the contrast. There's that many more pieces of information that could be used to fill in those gaps between these 255 values as you stretch them out to try to make them, to try to increase the contrast of your scene. So you would reduce the posterization of a JPEG file just because you have so much more data to work with in the raw format than you do in JPEG. So all of this comes back to this idea of this argument that we have between raw formats and the JPEG format. The raw format typically comes in three different bit sizes, 10, 12, or 14 bits. And none of these sound like a considerable jump over 8-bit, but recall that every additional bit means twice as much information. So we've gone from 256 values at 8-bit, we double it to get 512 at 9-bits, we double it again to get 1,000 values in 10-bit. So we have four times as many values in 10-bit than we do in 8-bit. We have four times as many values in 12-bit that we have in 10-bit, and four times again, 14 to 10. So basically, it doesn't matter whether you have a 10, 12, or 14-bit ADC. It does matter in the sense of your own camera, but it doesn't matter compared to a JPEG format. Most of the time, or almost all of the time, you're going to have far more bytes, far more bits to work with from the raw format, just because it's writing the raw amount of information to the camera's memory, and you can perform all of these calculations on your computer. All right, so if we take a look at some of the other things, the tonal curve is not applied to the raw format. You get to pick your own tone curve. And whenever you open up a raw file in a raw processor, it does a default tone curve for you. You might have seen something that looks vaguely like what we talked about before, might have looked something like that somewhere in the options for your raw file. This is the tone curve, and you get to modify it slightly. If you increase the contrast a little bit, the tone curve will be a little bit more vertical, for example. If you decrease the contrast, the tone curve will be a little bit more flat. But you get to pick your own tone curve as you process the raw file. The white balance is also not set in the raw file, and it's set in the JPEG. You can adjust the white balance. Almost all raw files are losslessly compressed, which means that all of the original data can be recreated. Whereas in JPEG, besides the fact that we're throwing away all of this data for 8 bits of information, the way it's stored on disk is you will not recover the exact original image that was created fed into the JPEG format. Now, the downsides, of course, of RAW is that it is not standard. Like we talked about before, the RAW format can change not only between manufacturers, but also from model to model. A newer model might have a different RAW format than an older model, probably because it has a fancier ADC, so there's more bits to work with, or maybe it does some other, or maybe something else, but but I mean, that could be a primary reason why the raw format would change. And also, when you have a raw format, you have to post-process it. You have to essentially go into your digital darkroom equivalent, like Photoshop or iPhoto or what have you, and process the image and set and apply all of these things that that are preset for you in a JPEG format to create a final output file that you can then send to other people. So this is really important, and in fact, one of the other things that RAW doesn't set for you is that demosaicing filter that we had mentioned before. This algorithm that takes all of the pixels and demosaics them. The computer, when it processes the raw file, will actually do this for you. So this might be a good thing. You could say, well, okay, they could improve then the demosaicing algorithm in software and I could get a better result. But you could also say, well, okay, maybe it's just not as good as the camera manufacturer's built-in demosaic filter. Really doesn't matter, but it's another thing that you get to consider, is that you get to do the demosaicing after the fact. You can do it, and you might be able to get a better quality image output as a result. So there's yet another thing that's important to talk about when we're talking about sensor linearity. You might have heard some people use this term online. They say exposed to the right. And the reason that people say this is because what you want to do is the whole idea of exposing to the right is that you increase the exposure of your image ever so slightly so that you use the highest bits of information. Because if you take an image and it has no highlights in it, for example, it has no areas that are at risk of overexposure, you are actually storing all of your data in the lowest half or so, the lowest third or a quarter of your image. And this just goes back to what we were talking about before, where the highest quantity of values are reserved for the top two stops worth of information. So if you expose your image in such a way that you use those bits of information, that you actually make it relatively bright, what they're saying is that you have more values to work with later on. So later on, you can decrease the exposure a little bit, and you just have more values that you can work with to increase the saturation or increase the contrast and reduce the chance of posterization. Now, people recommend this, but I think it's really dangerous to use exposed to the right. And the only reason I say that is that it becomes, I mean, it's already difficult not to overexpose an image when you're on a digital camera. And you can see that even this image right here has the tiniest amount of clipping in the blue channel. You can see that the blue channel has already been clipped, just the tiniest bit. So if you overexpose this whole thing, you're going to get even more overexposure as a result. So exposing to the right is sort of a useful tool if you want to get as many bits of information out of your image as possible, but only if you have a very well-controlled environment, only if you're absolutely sure that you're not going to make a bad situation worse in terms of overexposure. So if you have a scene that has relatively low dynamic range, that'd be a very good time to use this exposed to the right and then later on bring the exposure down. Now, to be clear, when you're exposed to the right, you can really only do this with the RAW, when you're saving it as a RAW format. If you use a JPEG, it's not really going to be any benefit at all, just because the tone curve has been applied and you're condensing all of those bits. This is the whole point of us using it. You're condensing all of these bits down to just a few bits of information at the highest end of the 8-bit value. But if you're using the RAW format, then you can, in fact, exposed to the right. And again, just be careful if you decide to do this, because you might make this sort of exposure situation a little bit worse by overexposing something that you didn't intend to do to begin with. And with that, we finish with digital cameras. So until next week, thank you all for coming, and we'll see you then.